as per a ritual space in a kind of convoluted way, just to kind of provide a contrasting kind of context between what we, you know, those of us who are generally trained in the classical texts and classical Hinduism and that kind of thing, and the notions that we have about Hindu ritual, you know, sacred space and things like that, and then suddenly, you know, confronted with the whole plethora of diaspora context, how to make sense out of it. So I thought maybe the best thing to do is to start from what we know in the classical tradition, and then in a kind of long, convoluted way, get to South Africa. So what I thought I would do is to kind of show you this classical structure of the Vedic altar and the structure of the ritual itself, the location of the various important components of that altar. Just to talk about some of those things and then get to where we want to get to. Perhaps the easiest way, I thought, I mean, ideally I should have actually had this documentary of Fritz Stoll shown here. I don't know how many of you have seen the documentary that Fritz Stoll documented that took place in 1975 in Kerala. It was a very unique Vedic ritual that apparently takes place once in 100 years. And the last one that took place prior to that was in 1875. And in 1975, this ritual called Agnichayana ritual, loosely translated as fire ritual, was performed by Nambudri Brahmins in Kerala. And a team of European scholars, mainly ritual specialists, went to this particular one, and Fritz Stoll led the team, and he documented the entire thing. It's it had two versions when he eventually edited it. There was about 16-hour long version that was kind of 16mm film thing that went on, because the ritual goes on for a number of days. And then he had a 3-hour long edited one, which is available on tape, videotape. I paid $450 for it from Berkeley. I hope they are underselling it now, because it's kind of, you know, finished its market, I think. but I didn't bring the copy, but I think when I come back I will bring a copy of it and we'll look at it. I thought a very useful way to talk about classical sort of Vedic ritual space is to kind of talk about what Fritz Stoll actually, you know, sort of documented there. Here is a Agnichayana ritual that is constructed like the shape of a bird, eagle. And the Nambudri Brahmins, being specialists of a particular branch of the, I think it was the Yajurveda sort of school, and they invited from throughout India specialists, you know, technical experts, from Orissa, Kashmir, and Bihar, some from Andhra Pradesh, and so on. And these are highly qualified technical experts. I think I'm trying to emphasize this one because you get to sort of distinguish what Brahman means in the diaspora context. Here, these families are actually the ones that became custodians of these select portions of the Vedic hymns and rules of ritual and so on. They preserved them in the families, and the sad thing is, of course, many of them have died now, and we have literally lost that tradition, actually, because these are never given to anybody outside. You're talking about the, you know, the insiders' epistemology, and that's the same problem. And it is never supposed to be given to anybody outside. So it's transmitted through families and through generations, and they are the only specialists, and they come to these rituals and they actually do their particular part, and they know the rules of it, including the geometric measurements, you know, the how they measure the altar to construct it and so on. All of those rules and specifications are in the hands of these families, and they preserve them. And so the ritual is constructed like an altar, like a bird. And over a period of 30 days, I think, the ritual carries on. And different experts actually inform various things about these things. And Fritz Stahl goes around sort of interviewing them. And, you know, of course, he gets into a kind of theory of language, you know, that based on Mimamsa sort of language theory. He uses this documentary to sort of support his theory of language. But all that I want to do is to kind of contrast that highly technical structure that at the end of the performance of the ritual, it is destroyed, set fire, and then everything is finished. So there is no more altar and so on. So that's kind of gives you an idea of what might have been in the pristine old times when Vedic rituals were performed, which of course don't happen these days. And then you have highly, again, equally complex ritual systems that are located in the temple structures. Somewhere in one of these books, Vasudha has a nice sort of picture of, diagram of the Kanchivaram sort of temple. I should have photocopied that one. But that also, he is equally informed by technical details found in various ritual texts, such as the Agama ritual texts, which are highly special and preserved in families and so on, again. And then we have when we get to the diaspora context, what we find is, when I was first asked to give a series of lectures, you know, on the diaspora Hindus, as soon as I was in South Africa, I was asked to also give some lectures on this one, and then I thought, what's the difference? I kind of didn't really think seriously. And then I went around doing this kind of field research to collect materials, to look around to see what these temples are like, what these, you know, various traditions and how they came to be what they are. It turned out very different. And of course, I ended up writing that book and on the Hindus in South Africa. One of the things that happened in South Africa is between 1860, maybe what I will do is I'll just give you a brief historical background of the community, how they got there, and then we take it from there. Between 1860 and 1911, when South Africa became, in 1911, the Union of South Africa, the Republic of South Africa that we know today, also it was the year, what it meant was the British imperial power was withdrawn and the Republic became independent and of British colonial administration. And it was also the year when all official immigration into South Africa from India was stopped. So that means no further Indian indentured laborers or passenger Indians came to South Africa. There were four language groups that eventually kind of turned out to be the groups that sort of came to South Africa. I think historically, I think there were more than those groups, but I think they kind of homogenized around those four groupings. One is the Tamil. First, you have the indentured laborers that were brought from India between 1860 and 1911. And then by about 1977 or so, the passenger Indians, known as the, you know, the merchant Indians, basically, from Gujarat and a few other places, mainly from Bombay and so on, came. They came on their own as merchants, but the indentured Indians came at the official request of the government of Natal for labor to work on the sugarcane industry farms. What's interesting about especially the indentured labor immigration was between 1860 and I think 1877. No caste details appeared in the ship list. I mean, you have this format, name and father's name and so on and so on, and then they have just a category for religion. Caste was blank, and then tribe and, you know, a few other things. And all the Hindus were listed in those first four ships that came during that time, listed as Gentus. And so no further caste details. And then there you had other details such as Malabari, Arab. Arab meant both. Malabari meant Christian, or it could be a Muslim. Arab meant Muslim. It's not that they came from Arabia, you know, Middle East or something, but it just meant Muslim. They could have been from Gujarat or western part of India or anywhere. And then after about five. I think about 1874 or so onwards, you have the passenger Indians coming. Then you have some details of caste background. Then you have the Tamil caste like Vanyas, you know, Govindans, and a whole range of other South Indian castes. What's interesting was by this time, 10 years into the immigration, the first generation already was switching castes. They were moving. There was upward mobility to acquire caste status. In other words, I noticed in some of the ship lists comparing that with individual family kind of document that had their particular details recorded and so on. You have in the ship list this guy's name as Iyer, but in the document it actually gives his actual caste name. So he seems to have, you know, it's not actually like it is either Valala or one of these local sort of lower caste, the so-called Sudra sort of category caste. There seemed to be some kind of attempt to somehow switch their sort of social status by acquiring different caste names. And eventually, I think by the second generation, you don't really know, certainly by the third generation, you have virtually a kind of a slow loss of caste status. And I think it's important to actually understand that, because later on, in the way the notion of Brahman conceptualized, the absence of caste becomes important as to how they did that. By 1864, you have the initial evidence of temple building in Natal. Between 1864 and 1885, some of the most prominent temples that exist today in Natal were built. And I've listed some of them there. Amzinto, these are place names. Amzinto is a place. Ambilo is also a location. These are the early farms where these Indian indentured laborers were located. I mean, they were situated there and they were farming in those areas. And Amzinto, Ambilo, Isibingo have pretty much become urbanized now. Mount Edgecombe and Tongat are little on the suburban areas, and they still have farming, sugarcane farming going on in those areas still. Tongat Hewlett owns most of the sugarcane farms in Natal today. They were bought up from all the individual white farmers. So it's the big company now that runs these farms, and what they're doing now is they know the agricultural reforms are coming after the Mugabe-Zimbabwe experience. And government of South Africa is introducing gradually the reforms, land reforms, and especially in the agricultural sector, to slowly bring in black farmers into the large-scale farming. So what Hewlett Tongat is doing is to sell out large hectares of land for private residential purposes and make money quickly. So there is that unfortunate thing going on. These are some of the oldest temples that were built in those areas. And during this period, what's interesting again is most of these temples were built by South Indian, Tamil, mainly Tamil communities. And Hindi-speaking communities began to build much later, more in the turn of the century, the 19th century, 20th century. And Gujaratis only built, they never built temples in South Africa. They only built, the recent one that they built was Swami Narayana Temple in Durban on Sydenham Road about 10 years ago. And that was actually a kind of a political stunt they pulled out. They had a school there, a Gujarati school. And in 94, when suddenly after the elections, the DOE, Department of Education, wanted to take that school and turn it into multiracial school. And immediately the Gujarati community didn't want to give it to multiracial school. They wanted to retain. So what they said to the government was they will just convert that into a cultural center and a little kind of primary kind of school. So they within 1 week they raised 10 million and they built in less than a year the temple, just to prevent it from being used as a multiracial. So if you think Europeans were racial, there you go. Some of the early temples were built, again, predominantly by South Indian builders. Now, these builders were not actually experts in temple building. They were like ordinary builders, basically. You know, they built very kind of basic homes. But these were people that probably had some sort of experience in some local temple buildings in India before they left. So they knew a little bit about it and had some understanding as to how these gopuras were built and so on. So these first three that I listed were basically South Indian people, builders. Ramji was a Gujarati passenger. He built this one temple in Verulam, also near Tongat, and I was surprised that Gandhi opened this temple in 1913, a year before he left South Africa. In 1914, Gandhi left South Africa to go to India eventually. I want to talk a little about the structure of the temple. There are two temple sort of types were identified in South Africa. That is, one is the Dravidian style, the other one known as the Nagara style. The South Indian temples are more ornate, actually. They have more kind of iconography inside, pictures and so on. I have some pictures, but I've been trying to download and then print them. I couldn't. For some reason, my computer was not reading those CDs. So maybe at some point I will try and show them to you. Now, the South Indian style is characterized by east-west orientation. In a way, it's not unlike the typical Vedic. That's the kind of orientation that all temples seem to have. So they seem to have followed that one. Now, how they knew this, you know, these are not builders that were like the ones that come to US now. You know, these are silpis, technical silpis that come to California and other places, you know, Pennsylvania, where they built these, you know, Vishnu temple, Venkateswara temple, and the one in California. What was it called? The Pittsburgh was the famous one, and also the California one also is the same, Venkateswara temple. The only difference is the California one, not far from Los Angeles, actually. It's between it's called it's between Santa Barbara and Los Angeles. It's in a valley, actually, unlike the Venkateswara temple, which is on top of the hill. Now, but apparently this one, it is in a valley, but it is nonetheless surrounded by seven hills. Like the Venkateswara temple is known as Saptagiri, sort of. Venkateswara is known as Saptagiri Vasa. You know, the main temple is surrounded by seven hills. It's built in the, you know, on top of the hill. So they kind of try to emulate. So when they saw this location, they kind of thought this is ideal. So you can see how in diaspora they tried to kind of recap, you know, that kind of idea when they built it. But here, for these guys to know the northeast, east-west orientation, you know, must be pretty sort of interesting, because these are not experts, silpis or anything. And the South Indian temples followed a square plan of the main shrine. And in front of the temple there is a flag post, which is very unique and a sort of important for the South Indian temples. It's known as Kodi in Tamil. And the North Indian temples are marked by plain and simple design. And it's like squarish kind of building, you know. Reminds you of any of these Mughal kind of sort of designs. And both these temples were marked by their syncretic elements. This is very important. In other words, the circumambulatory passage around the shrine in all temples, and the vertical lines and blind arches introduced in the Dravidian temples. These actually have elements of all different linguistic kind of backgrounds and, you know, different temple architectural designs and so on. They seem to have kind of informed each other as to, you know, where they came from, and then sort of gathered information as to different styles and coalesced into one of these things. And you would find sometimes southern deities being adorned by adorned in the Gujarati dresses. And the domes are looking like the Islamic sort of domes on top of the shrine. Largely you would have these different denominations, mainly three sort of temple types of denominations you could identify. One is, of course, the Tamils are predominantly Shaivite, and the North Indians were Vaishnavites, Hindi-speaking communities predominantly. So the most of the South Indian temples, the Dravidian architectural designs, were informed by these Shaivite kind of designs and so on. So you have in these temples Shiva as the main sort of sovereign deity, the main sort of deity around which everything else is built. And you have like the main deity in the center of the shrine, and then you have on the right hand side, or sometimes on the left hand side, Ganesha's shrine, and then you have the consort of the, you know, either Shiva or Vishnu, whoever it is. And then at the in the front of the temple you have these two guardian deities. Most South Indian temples have Madurai Veeran, who is actually a village god, known as the guardian deity, and Hanuman. Hanuman is unique for Hindi-speaking people very commonly. Also, I mean, you find in the South Indian context also, but Hindi-speaking people have a particular interest in Hanuman worship. So they have Hanuman as a kind of a guardian deity, and then they have the Madurai Veeran, who is actually identified in the South Indian village kind of context as a guardian deity. And the other denomination, the sectarian branch you would find is the Mariamman, the goddess, generally known as Amman temple. What's interesting is you would find in any given temple complex, compound, all these three. Now, which is rather interesting. In other words, you don't find even in India, in modern India, like that. Like you have the Shiva temple, that's it. I mean, you have all the Shaivite allied deities in it. The western walls, eastern walls, all these will be kind of depicted, you know, by these deities and so on. And then you have the Vaishnava temple, and then, you know, you have the goddess temples and so on, but never kind of mixing all of them so kind of clearly. In the diaspora context here in South Africa, you have all these three as, of course, as individual shrines. You will, you know, find them in the same complex, in the same temple compound. I believe these early settlers wanted to somehow bring all the community together to the same kind of place where they all could worship in their different ways. And especially bringing what is traditionally considered by anthropologists as a folk village goddess tradition, which appears in the villages on the periphery. You see, if you go to any typical village, you have the main Brahmanical temple in the village, and then you have these non-Brahmanical folk village kind of goddess, or, you know, male gods or whatever, on the boundaries of the village. Here you have everything brought together within the structure and the complex of the temple. In a way, I think they were trying to sort of bring everything together, the Brahmanical and the non-Brahmanical elements. Majority Hindus that came to South Africa were non-Brahmanical people, mainly from the so-called Shudra communities, and there might have been also substantial numbers of the fifth group, even below that, you know, Shudra community. But through caste sort of mobilization and transformation, the caste has virtually vanished, really. What happened in the context of South Indian community was it took on a kind of a linguistic formation. So you have last names appearing like Pillai, Naidu, Reddy, sort of so on, Govindan, Govinda, you know, there are different variations of that name, all indicating the South Indian Tamil kind of Naidu, etc. And again, you have Naidus of Tamil background and Naidus of Telugu background. They were Naidus that came from the coastal Andhra area, the West Godavari, East Godavari area. And then you have Naidus coming from Tamil Nadu region, like the Tirunelveli, Tanjavur, all these places. There was a migration of labor from Andhra into Karnataka and Tamil Nadu in the 16th century, actually, back when the famously known as the fall of Tanjore, the period. When Krishnadevaraya, the then Vijayanagara Empire, you know, the ruler of the Vijayanagara Empire, his prime minister was a Telugu man, Timma Arasu. Arasu is actually a Telugu name. You know, you have Devaraj Arasu, the former chief minister of Karnataka. Arasu is a Telugu name, actually. And I think they came from that Arasu family. Now, Timma Arasu was a Telugu prime minister of Krishnadevaraya. And there was a famine at that time throughout in the Tamil Nadu, and yeah. And he moved a lot of labor into Tamil Nadu out of the northern part of Andhra, the Nalgonda, the Karnool, you know, that kind of area, into Karnataka and Tamil Nadu to construct. There were all kinds of construction activities he launched, temples and, you know, local reservoirs and all kinds of things. So I believe that some of these were actually the result of that migration into Tamil Nadu. So they retained a little bit of local language and so on in the house. So if you speak to them in Telugu, they would understand. But they, for practical purposes, they spoke Tamil. So when they came to South Africa, they quickly integrated with the rest of the Tamil community rather than with the Telugu community. So you ended up Telugu Naidus and Tamil Naidus. And they spelled very differently. N-A-I-D-U, Naidu, would be a Telugu from coastal Andhra districts. And N-A-I-D-O would be the Tamil. And see how they actually interestingly kept their identities separate. And so the caste transformation was so massive that these last names simply kind of as memories of their earlier caste backgrounds and so on. And some of these, of course, have acquired these last names. And same thing happened with the Hindi communities, the Sings, and you know, whole range of. I would imagine there are actually, according to Shipley's, some of these people indicated different locations of North India. Some came from Bihar, Bengal, UP, even up to Punjab and so on, Maharashtra. But they all actually panned out to become homogenized as Hindi-speaking people. They kind of lost their respective languages, like Bengalis, probably. But they might have been smaller groups. I don't think they were like... The biggest group was the Bhojpuri-speaking, North Indian, Hindi-speaking people. So that became like the all-encompassing, North Indian kind of group. So you have a homogenization of all these North Indian groups into Hindi-speaking community eventually. And then Gujaratis are the only ones that retained caste, even to this day, because of their trading activities with India, because they were trading all the time, even during apartheid. They were trading with India, and they were importing, exporting, and all kinds of things. And they maintained their accounts, books of accounts, in Gujarati language. Initially, I believe it was to dupe the tax system, because they had one system accounting in Gujarati, and then the official one would be in English. So they would show the English one to the tax office, and the other ones are the original, real ones. Actually, how much was imported and how much was kind of sold for how much and all that. And they also brought their alliances, marriage partners from India until the first couple of generations. Gradually, of course, that also stopped for them, but they retained their caste sort of affiliations. And if you notice the initial formation of organizations within the Gujarati community, most of the organizations were actually caste-based organizations. You will have the Surat Mahasabhas. We know all those communities that came from Surat were Vanya caste. And there were Mochi, Gujarati Mochi, you know, caste organizations, and eventually they kind of died out, and they began to organize around regions of Gujarat. And today you have, like, broadly they call themselves Gujarati Kendra Mahasabha, you know, things like that, but they still have subtle sort of caste hierarchies built into it. They like to be sort of presented as non-caste-based organizations, but the leadership and the hierarchy is pretty much caste-based. One of the interesting thing about the Gujaratis was the even Gujarati Muslims retained caste status, because you have Gujarati Patel, Gujarati Rajab, who could be Muslim. Rajab could be a Muslim Gujarati or a Hindu Gujarati, so you have both. Or a Patel, it could be a Muslim Gujarati or a Hindu Gujarati, and they come from the same villages. And the mixing of Brahmanical and non-Brahmanical deities in the temples, especially finding a place for Amman worship in all these temples, is very unique. There are special temples for goddess worship separately, such as the Isipingo temple, which has become very famous in South Africa. It has become like a tourist attraction, actually. During the Easter period, it starts on Good Friday and ends on the Easter Monday. They have these rituals performed for the Mariamman in the temple, and South Africans from all over South Africa come there during that time. And you have predominantly they offer non-vegetarian sacrifices and all of that, like chicken and goat and sheep and all kinds of things. And of course there are some that vegetarian sort of offerings also are made. And then there is the other one, the famous Second River Temple on the banks of Amgeni River. It became known as Second River Temple because the first temple that was on the river, there's only one river, but the first temple that was built on the river, on the banks of the river, was removed because when the roads department built a highway in that area, they had to remove this temple. And they apparently took the top of the temple, the Gopura top, and moved it to the new temple. So that's when it became known as the second river temple. River temple, first one, the second one. And that's next to that is Draupadi Amman temple. It stands. There are three temples on that road. It's known as Belair Temple. Belair Road actually runs from the University of Natal, the back of University of Natal, behind Ambilo, and then that road comes right through and meets the freeway on the National Highway. Along that road, there is on the roadside itself is the Ganganamma Temple. That is the nothing to do with the Gan, you know, the Ganga of the Sanskrit. This is the village goddess. And then past that one, there is this second river temple known as the Draupadi Amman Temple. And then one next to it is the Katamana Temple, that is the Shiva Temple. The Draupadi Amman Temple is rather very interesting. It's actually Alf Hiltebeete, his two volumes on Draupadi. He talks about the cult of Draupadi in South India, starting from Tamil Nadu right up to parts of Andhra Pradesh. It's a very unique tradition that actually survived in Tamil Nadu. And it is actually also the tradition that informed the translation of Villiputtur's translation of Mahabharata. He translated the classical Sanskrit text into Tamil, but he actually adapted the local variants. And here in this translation, as well as in this Draupadi cult, Draupadi becomes the goddess, no longer just the classical heroine. And she is the one that kills Duryodhana, the villain, chief villain, and takes the sort of final this thing, not Bhima. And she actually then becomes the goddess, and as the goddess Kali, she then, you know, kills. So here is the play of Durga and Mahisha kind of, you know, image here. Mm-hmm. Duryodhana representing Mahisha and Draupadi representing Durga and so on. So that's the kind of temple sort of culture that one finds in the, you know, South African context. And some of the interesting developments that actually happened in the practice of the priesthood and so on in South Africa is rather interesting. In the early days, I was quite struck in the photographs. The priests were dressed like the, you know, Christian ministers. They were wearing white cassocks and, you know, doing these chants and all of these things. But you could see them dressed like a, and there is a girdle around the waist. And one of the interesting things in these temples, even today, is it doesn't happen in my experience in India and elsewhere. There is always an emphasis to explain before and after they perform these various rituals, the symbols and so on. This is a kind of an effort to educate, and they realize that they have lost some of these traditions, and the priest actually tries to take that opportunity to explain and inform his audience and his, you know, the people that come there. And then you find some of these rules of the rituals, adaptations, local sort of taking into account the local building codes and so on. For instance, lighting of camphor, breaking coconut inside the temple are prohibited. That means, you know, it actually has to do with the health department's code, you know, that you don't sort of create situation where there is, you know, possibility for flies and, you know, these things. So they take it to a place under the tap, and then they break it and then bring the coconuts inside. And then the calendar also was substantially transformed, the religious calendar. In the Indian context, we know that it is very technical and highly specific. You know, the muhurtams and all of these are carefully calculated by the priests and so on, the pandits. But here they had to kind of somehow homogenize it and simplify it. It had also to do with the you know, colonial history, because in the time of their indentured labor, they were not permitted to go and do their, you know, what rituals and so on every day. So they were given a day off. Usually it was a Sunday, because the master's holiday is also a Sunday. So they were given these things, and some the farm employers, they were quite liberal with them. They also gave them land to build their temples and so on. That's how the temples that were built in these farm areas were actually lands given by either William Campbell or one of these big land lords, you know, that owned these big farms. So there was a substantial adjustment in terms of the calendar and the timings. So these are pretty much fixed throughout the year, and every temple in every part of South Africa would follow the same thing. And so what they would do is they will create their own local calendar, which would be sent out to all these various temples, and they would follow those timings and so on. On Sunday morning, most of the temples have their rituals, because that's the only time most people could go and attend. And generally Hindus, you know, are not like temple-going sort of, it's not a regular temple-going kind of culture, because they go only when they need to, you know, when they have a reason to, when they have some, you know, difficulty or a problem or whatever, that's when they go to the temple and, you know, do their prayers and so on. Unlike the Muslims and Christians, you know, Hindus go, you know, like, there are some, of course, go regularly, like in India, every Saturday or a Friday, you know, there is a tradition of, you know, especially women and senior people going to temples. But modern India, even in India, modern India, it is kind of disappearing. And the other day, Deepankar Gupta, he from Delhi JNU, he said in one of his keynote speeches, "I'm a Hindu, but where is time for me to do all these things? You know, we don't have time." So that's how it is. And when it comes to priesthood, when people sort of call someone Brahman, it doesn't mean that person comes from the caste Brahmin. It simply means anyone who acquired this kind of profession as a kind of, for most of them, it's kind of a side thing, really. You know, he has his own sort of profession, like he may be an employee in some place, or even some of them are highly educated, you know, lawyers, doctors, and so on. They just take on this other responsibility as a priest. And so they are known as Brahmins, but they're not like the Brahmin priest, you know, caste kind of attachment to it. So they don't have any organized sort of schools to learn these rituals and so on. These are passed on from, you know, elders to the next generation. So in a way they follow some kind of parampara sort of tradition. But one could learn from any elder from anywhere else. It's not necessarily from your father. You can go and watch others doing it. And most people pick up from, you know, what they see around. Now, this suddenly began to change in 1990 and thereafter, when Sri Lankan priests were suddenly beginning to come in. many of the by this time you have a highly established, well-to-do kind of strong business community among Indians. Many of the indentured laborers also kind of built themselves up and became well-placed in the economy. And they were able to then go to India and then negotiate with temples in India to bring priests. But they couldn't bring priests from India because of the absence of any diplomatic relations between India and South Africa up to 92-93. In fact, only in 94, the diplomatic relations were officially sort of formalized. But from 92 onwards, you know, there were some sort of relationships. So up to that period, mainly the Sri Lanka provided priests. So they could go to Sri Lanka and then bring priests. And these are pretty much similar to the South Indian Brahmin sort of priests. And they, most of them actually were trained in South Indian temples, the Sri Lankan priests. So they carry the same kind of tradition, rules, and so on. One interesting thing that actually I should mention is that the Sri Lankan priests, which is common in India, South India especially, when they are in the inner sanctum, the inside the shrine, they remove, you know, the upper clothes, and they are pretty much bare-chested, you know, and they have sometimes a kind of a like a, what is it, a shawl sort of thrown on the shoulders, but sometimes they take it out and then they tie it around their waist. So they pretty much expose their upper body, and this became an issue for the local priests, because what happened was local priesthood kind of pretty much appropriated European cultural sort of habits and etiquette and, you know, public, you know, sort of behavior and all of these things. So not wearing something above you, you know, on your chest and so on to expose your chest in public is considered sort of not sort of nice, you know, not a good behavior kind of thing. So they found these guys doing this and they said, no, you can't do that. So there was a big issue, and I attended one discussion in Verulam Temple, Shiva Temple, one evening. And the debate was so heated, and they wanted to actually send all these Sri Lankan priests back to Sri Lanka. Because it's like become an issue because, you know, they are exposing their bodies to their women. You know, so that was the issue, really. You know, these guys come here and expose their bodies to our women. What is this? So it's kind of taken on a kind of a moral issue, you know, kind of degenerate morality, I would think. But you can see how the changes began to happen. 10 years or 12 years into the Sri Lankan priesthood now, they're kind of pretty much settled in, but they're not yet fully accepted. They're still seen as kind of outside tradition from the local people. In most temples, except where a Sri Lankan priest exists, there are no daily temple rituals. I mean, only the Sri Lankan priests have this habit of every day opening the temple and doing the, you know, the all the initial rituals and so on. And most South African Hindus, depending on their linguistic background, perform at home a simple kind of sun worship and lighting of the lamp in front of their preferred deity. Mostly it's known as Kamakshi light. In Tamil they call it Kamakshi Velukku. And the North Indians have these flagpoles in front of their houses. You know, usually the orange color, red flag, and a yellow flag. These are always posted, you know, and by these flags you can tell whether it's a Hindi family or a South Indian family living there. So South Indian homes don't have those. Only the Hindi-speaking North Indian homes have these flags in front of them. They actually, around that, they have a little shrine for Hanuman, and they do these, some, you know, very devoutly do it daily, but at least on a Friday, most Hindi homes, they do these Hanuman prayers and so on, Lakshmi prayers. The marriages and birth ceremonies, funeral ceremonies, are heavily localized because it's very interesting. Sometimes when a South African Indian, there were occasions that I know when, you know, there was this family lost somebody. I mean, the guy died in Madras. And his family wanted that funeral to be done in South Africa, not in Madras, by a South African priest, not by a local Tamil or any priest. So that's how sort of strong they became in terms of their local traditions and so on. For some reason, they think that they have developed a tradition that they hold on to and they believe in and so on. So you kind of have a local diaspora kind of ritual tradition developing. When it comes to temple festivals, main festivals and so on, Diwali is probably is the one that could become the pan-Hindu festival. All the other festivals are kind of different for South Indians and North Indians and so on. In fact, at our university, when we were debating in the Senate for religious holidays, and eventually we agreed in the Senate that all religious communities could be given two holidays, and then Hindus couldn't come up with the second one. I mean, Diwali was the first one, and we couldn't agree on the second one because everybody had a different. So the Senate then ruled, okay, Diwali is the only one. So there is no second holiday. All the other, I mean, the Muslims have two holidays, Jewish people have two holidays, Christians have Christmas and Easter, and yeah, but Hindus have only one holiday, and by their own making. Yeah, effectively, I just want to sort of summarize. You could see from what I sort of, in a convoluted way, constructed a kind of description of what it is we see here in the South African context, in the context of the temple, the rituals that they perform and the festivals that they kind of celebrate. They have developed a kind of a unique sort of tradition of their own that they seem to be very proud of. And they seem to hold on to. And in doing so, they seem to have sort of, through their memory or through some exchange of people, etc., brought in some Brahmanical elements. There are some essential Brahmanical elements around which they constructed it. But the interesting thing is the manner in which the non-Brahmanical elements that we somehow categorically separate in the classical kind of sense in India, here you find all of them sort of syncretistically mixed. And this, for me, raises interesting questions as to how we actually study Hinduism vis-a-vis these materials. You know, when we talk about Hinduism, you know, teaching Hinduism outside India, for instance, becomes interesting, becomes an interesting exercise, because where do we begin? Can we actually teach all of these and say this is introduction to Hinduism, and then call it, you know, there goes Madhva, Shankara, everybody else, and you have all these. Now, it raises interesting methodological questions, theoretical questions, how we define Hinduism and what methods do we use. These are, many of these are not text-based traditions. These are oral transmissions. You know, when I was writing this book, I had no written materials to go by. I had to interview scores and scores of people to talk to them, to kind of understand what they're saying, how they're trying to recap these things and, you know, understand them and how they want to be, you know, known. All of these things. So there is this other sort of dialectic between the orality and the text, the popular and the classical, the Sanskritic and the folk, or non-Sanskritic, Brahmanical, non-Brahmanical. The so-called, you see, the idea in which we sort of categorically distinguish them, here they are coalesced. You know, they are all kind of mixed. I tried to kind of separate them when I was writing this book, but it was so difficult. And I eventually found myself doing gross injustice to that tradition, because they don't think in terms of Brahmanical, non-Brahmanical kind of thing. These are all together. That's the tradition. You know, caste is absent, you know, with the exception of the Gujarati thing. Even Gujarati priesthood, there is no Brahmin priesthood as such. To be fair, actually, there are a few Brahmins that they call themselves Maharaj. Now, they have become the, in the North Indian case, some of them have taken up the priesthood, but many other North Indian priests are not necessarily Maharaj community. Now, we know Maharaj is a kind of a, you know, in the hierarchy of the North Indian Brahmin caste, it's right at the bottom. They were actually originally in the UP tradition, for instance, they were cooks. Maharajas were basically cooks who cooked the food in the temples and or in the Hindu ritual ceremonies and so on. Because it would have been unlikely that any orthodox Brahmin would have dared leave India to come to South Africa at that point in that time. So there were these kind of, right at the bottom of that Brahmanical ladder, there might have been some on the periphery who kind of jumped ship and said, all right, there is an opportunity, let's go. So they went. So barring that kind of thing, and Gandhi is actually an exception, really. You know, the Surti Gujaratis, you know, they came not as kind of, you know, they came with all their tradition. They were passenger. They secluded themselves all along the Vanya people. In fact, in the days of in the thick of the colonial period, they actually wanted to be classified as whites, the Gujarati merchants and the Parsis. They wanted to be classed as whites because they distinguished themselves from the rest of, indentured Indians, saying we are, you know, whiter than these people, fair-looking people, and we are not them. And then, of course, the song changes later on. But you can see how opportunistic it becomes, right? So it's a kind of interesting tradition to study and to understand how they have reconstructed their Hindu ritual space, thereby reconstituting themselves as an interestingly sort of new community, a unique Hindu community, and they're very, very sort of Hindu in their identity. They're very, very strong. I mean, my wife is a fourth generation Indian from there. Now, you talk about Hinduism, anything, she will kill you. That is how staunch she is. I mean, they're very, 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 you know, protective about Hinduism, and that's why at one point the RSS had a very good chance of infiltrating South African Hindu community. They tried. But then later on, they kind of fizzled out. But so you could easily, using their strong sort of affiliation, affinity is probably a better word, affinity to their heritage, their language, their tradition, and so on. You could actually turn them into a very fundamentalist group, you know. But majority of them very, very liberal at the same time and very free-thinking, sort of, you know, they're strong in when it comes to temples and rituals, and so they very religiously follow these. I mean, in the month of September and October, when Paratasi month is observed, September 17th to this October 17th, which is yesterday, Paratasi month, it's called the month of Paratasi, when all the, even the non-vegetarian Hindus, they don't eat non-vegetarian stuff. They become vegetarian. They're very, very strict. It's kind of, you can see it in supermarkets. Suddenly the vegetable prices go up. Nobody buys, you know, meat is not sold. I mean, you don't see any meat selling in the supermarkets and so on. So that's how very religious they are. And they have the Mariamman prayers, Kavadi rituals. On Kavadi day, in any average temple, and imagine there are about no less than 200 or 300 temples in the greater Durban area, small to big ones. In any average temple, there are anywhere between 50 to 350 or 400 Kavadi. Kavadi is taking place. In other words, individuals taking Kavadi in those temples, carrying Kavadi. I don't know if anybody knows anything about Kavadi ritual. It's a kind of a unique. It's in sort of it's a festival basically in celebration of Murugan. Basically, Murugan is considered the son of another manifestation of Subramanya. But also is the son of Shiva and so on. So the Tamil variant is Murugan. Murugan worship is very big. Kavadi is a ritual that is very unique in Tamil Nadu. And people take a vow. When they sort of reach that festival time, to fulfill that vow, they carry this Kavadi. You know, it's like a sort of pole with two sort of pots.
Baskets.
Yeah, baskets of, you know, earthen pots or metal pots. I mean, like these, you know, the usual water pots. Here it's kind of designed like a circular, semicircular kind of thing, and it's made out of wood. So they carry it on their head. It's decorated with flowers and all that. And there is also self-immolation that takes place along with this because of the fast during a period of 40 days.
Self-immolation?
In other words, they kind of inflict, you know, pain in the body through carrying hooks and...
Flagellation.
Yeah. Sorry, I used the wrong term. It's like the Muharram kind of festival among Muslims. They inflict pain by sort of hurting themselves with sort of whole sort of bunches of knives and all that. Here they put hooks on their bodies and sort of coconuts and some of them actually pull chariots with these hooks, and it's very massive pierce like a trisul from this end to this end. It comes out this way and then they tie lemon on both sides. You know, they actually sort of push lemons on both sides, and then through the tongue, you know, one needle comes out. So the tongue is jutting out, and this needle it's like this, and so the guy can't speak. And then there is said to be the power of Murugan or Hanuman or even Mariamman coming upon them. So there is that manifestation of these things. So they kind of behave like Hanuman, the guy who gets this Hanuman sort of spirit. behaves like a Hanuman, and so on, you know. So it's a massive kind of phenomenon that's worth documenting and studying. And there are so many social, cultural, sort of interesting aspects to it, to the study. Interesting stuff.
I wanted to ask you, how would an Indian Brahman regard these manifestations of a tradition which would seem to be not just non-textual but impure rituals?
Interesting. When the Sri Lankan priests came, the Sri Lankan priests don't perform rituals in these festivals. They dissociate themselves. I mean, the Mariamman rituals and so on. In the same temple where a Sri Lankan priest is appointed, he does the rituals in the main temple, that is the Shiva temple or Vishnu temple, whichever is the main one, and then he lets people go there, you know. But they have a local priest who does these, you know, like a South African Hindu priest, you know, trained in local customs and so on. They do these things. The Sri Lankans have dissociated themselves. When I observed this Draupadi festival, it's a kind of a massive thing that goes on for about 18 days. You know, it actually recounts the 18 days of the war. And they have what is called Thirukkottu. You know the meaning of Thirukkottu. It's Thirukkootam, actually. It's it's a meeting, you know, the old village sort of practice of where the Bhagavatars, you know, recited these myths and, you know, the stories, narratives and so on, drawing from Sanskrit and folklore, etc. They would reenact these things and kind of engage the community through the night. You know, until early morning. It's a kind of same tradition that happens here. So during those 18 days of Draupadi festival, in these temples there is bhajans and these enactment of these various things happen. And then on the main day, the ritual actually begins where the in this particular temple, the second river Draupadi temple. The ritual begins on the bank of the Amgeni River, where actually they sort of all those who have taken vows gather at that place, and they are prepared by the local priest, you know, because subsequently they will get to the temple in a procession, where they will walk on the fire. It's called fire walking ritual. So there are a number of sort of rituals that take place here on the bank first, on the river bank. And then from there they take the procession through the streets and then go into the temple. And then these people that have taken vows, they would have been preparing for it like the previous 40 days. They would have been practicing all these, you know, not eating this, not eating this, not smoking, fasting and all that. And they would walk through the fire. And what's interesting about this, your question is, when the rituals were performed, I was standing observing this, and I happened to be standing right next to the Sri Lankan priest who is up in that Katana temple, who is the efficient priest. Now, he was standing next to me like a spectator. And I said, aren't you going to do these rituals? And he said, no, we don't do this. So, you know, so he had this typical Brahmanical, non-Brahmanical kind of distance. That here, you know, they don't, you know, in South Africa, they don't observe that kind of distinction. It's very interesting, actually.
One little quick question about the language is being used during the
performance of ritual.
It's
and
both.
So I was wondering, if it is Sanskrit, is there a difference between the local priest, as you say, and the priest that came from Sri Lanka? Or is this part of the, maybe the...
Well, most of the South Indian priests, South Indian Brahmins, as they call them, they use Tamil sort of
so
chants, basically. And there are a few Sanskrit verses they kind of memorize. They don't know anything about the meaning or whatever, but they just say it. But same thing with the North Indians. They have more of the Sanskrit sort of chants.
Mm-hmm.
But again, they don't know the meanings and what have you. If you ask them, they know nothing about it.
So
but
that's
they just
for both types of priests.
Yeah. But they just, you know, they have memorized these. So they just, you know, read them as part of the rituals. But the Sri Lankan priests, they seem to kind of follow more of the Sanskrit chants and so on. So there is that kind of...
Similarly, do they read the Mahabharata in that 18-day period? And if they read it, do they read
the
Tamil or do they read Sanskrit?
Yeah. In the olden days, I believe, they used to read the Villi Paratham, the Tamil version of it, portions of it, during that whole 18 nights. When it is enacted, they would read portions of it. You see, what's interesting is these early settlers, although they came from a variety of lower caste, you know, the Shudra, the so-called Shudra, the, you know, they could be Pillais, Reddis, and Velalas, and, you know, all kind of Nayakars, all these people. But they were very well versed in Tamil. You know, they kind of, they could read and write, I mean, not all of them, but some of them. And they immediately started Tamil schools, you know, around the little shrines or temples that they built. And they started teaching Tamil. And many of these early first, second generations probably had their schooling in these Tamil schools. And they probably had about up to standard 2, 3, and then they started becoming, you know, employed in these various things. Because in the days when there was no educational facilities given to the Indians by the colonial, you know, administration, those were the schools that they used to educate themselves, a little bit of maths and Tamil and some cultural things and so on. And then slowly then, by the 1924-25, Sir Shastri, he made a visit to, he was sent as the government of India representative to South Africa to actually examine the situation of the Indians in South Africa and report. And then in 1925, under his sort of leadership, he negotiated a deal with the South African government, what became known as a 1925 Cape Town Agreement, under which government of South Africa agreed to provide for the first time educational facilities. And that's when, during his time, I think it was after he left, they built what became known as Shastri College, the first Indian training school for training teachers to teach Indian children in schools and so on. So they started establishing. You see, they had, by then, by 1920s, they had established a lot of schools, but they had lack of teachers, qualified teachers. So then there was the need to, you know, and they couldn't go to, you know, white teacher training colleges. So then Shastri established that particular sort of agreement under which that Shastri College was established, and then they started going to some of the subsequent stalwarts of Indian community came out of that college, and then only in 19 late 60s, somewhere about 66 or so, the first college, the higher education college, was established in the Salisbury Island outside Durban, which became the University of Durban Westport, the Indian campus when it became fully fledged as a university in late 60s, can't remember the year. And then it became a university, proper university, where they offered higher education degrees, BA, all this.
But I guess most of them are Tamil speaking people.
Well, you see, you have about Hindi and Tamil speaking people would be about equal numbers, more or less. These are the major groupings, and then you have a small Telugu community, and then you have a small. Gujarati is the smallest group. In the South Indian case, Telugus and Tamils have kind of pretty much integrated. Even these coastal district Telugus that came.
You were referring to Varatashi Masam.
Yeah, all of them.
All Tamil customs.
Yeah.
Rather than Telugu or other South Indian.
During that time, the Hindi speaking.
And also, you were referring to Tirukkottu.
Yeah.
They are all Tamil terminologies.
Yeah. I mean, initially that's why I said most of the religious institutions and